The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Between the Synapse with Mark Tobin. If you're looking to learn something useful, you've come to the wrong place. But as Belushi once said, it don't cost nothing. So let's get things started. Here's Mark Tobin.
All right, welcome to Between the Synapse. I'm your host, Mark Tobin. Thanks for joining, be it live or be it via podcast. Today, special day, it is our first return act on Between the Synapse. We'll get to that in just a second. Just a little bit of business. If you'd like to check out previous podcasts, including the one of our soon-to-be-mentioned guest, you can do so by checking out my blog at BetweenTheSynapse.com. Right there on the homepage, just look on the right side. You can see a list of all the previous shows, and you can listen to all of them more than once, even if you want, if you're so inclined. Also, you'll see a box where you can subscribe and receive notices of future shows. I encourage you to do that, and that way you'll know everything that I know, which, quite frankly, isn't a whole lot. Also, if you have questions or comments or even want to ask a question live on the radio, you can do so. Just give us a call at 866-472-5788. Well, I don't know if you've been paying attention, but there is this this group called ISIS, Islamic State, a couple other choice words as well that some people have used, and they have been making a bit of noise. There's also a lot of other stuff going on in the region that we'll probably get to help us understand the latest of what's going on with this group and maybe even help us understand the latest of what's going on in Yemen, which also has some very interesting dynamics. I've invited back to the show Dr. Jonathan Adelman, who is a professor of international studies at the University of Denver. He is an expert in China and Russia, but also covers many areas of the globe. He's written a number of books, has appeared on just about every cable news show there is, and maybe will soon to be. He also had the privilege of being the dissertation advisor to former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and there's a number of other accolades that I'm sure I can get to later in the show. But for now, I just want to welcome back Jonathan Adelman. Jonathan, how are you?
Great. Good to be on your show, Mark.
You know, so the thing that really popped in my mind as of late, and one of the things that I wanted to get your thoughts on with regard to ISIS is this attempt at, I guess it's at helping sort of thwart the recruitment effort of ISIS. You know, ISIS is through various means and social media and other means of contact, recruits from all over the globe, and you hear these stories all the time, whether it's somebody from, you know, Minnesota or someone from Europe, you know, they're going over in order to help, quote, their cause as either fighters or supporters of the cause. And they use various kinds of doctrine in order to encourage these people to support that cause. So lately I've been hearing this this effort in order to I guess de-religionize ISIS and separate it from Islam. And I understand the intent, meaning in order to discourage Muslims around the world from having anything to do with ISIS. You want to say, look, this is not an Islamic group. This has nothing to do with our religion. I understand that from a strategic purpose. But at some level, though, I also find it a bit disingenuous because the basis for ISIS in many ways is no different than it is for other radical Islamic terrorist groups. And so I'm a little bit concerned that if you go that route, that you know when you kind of avoid what is the a root cause, and I'm not saying that it's not a perversion of the religion that these groups adhere to, but if you ignore that, that you're not ultimately going to reach a real resolution. And I wanted to get your thoughts on this because you've been looking at this and writing about this quite a bit over the last few years.
Well, Mark, I think you're just right on about this. There is a clear effort to kind of de-Islamify ISIS, but the reality is that if you start just with its leader, if you start with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, where did he go to school? He got his BA, MA, and PhD in Islamic studies from the Islamic University of Baghdad. If you look at the people that he is associated with, he is very much of a strong, you know, Sunni Muslim. In fact, he used to lead, according to American sources, prayer services. So he is deeply religious, and the whole notion of a caliphate, it seems to me that for Americans, history is a distant shore. And I understand that because we've had a very fortunate history compared to that of many countries around the world. We haven't been invaded since 1814, you know, tens of millions of immigrants, prosperity, etc. But the reality is that history here is extremely important. And the caliphate, which was formed after the death of Muhammad in the 7th century, is not just a figment of the imagination of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. It was a real living entity that incorporated the essence of Islam after the death of the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century. So, and its appeal is therefore very strong within certain kinds of Islamic groups. Now, that's not to say that the majority of Muslims around the world support that. They don't. But it is to say there's a sufficient number. I think one study came up with out of 1.6 billion, 100 or 200 million that have some sympathy for it, to cause a great deal of concern. So in its content, in the things that they're doing, like decapitating people, forcing Christians and Zaydis and others who are not Muslims to either be, you know, converted to Islam or to be shot or to pay a double tax, it's wrapped up in Islam, a certain kind of Islam. It's not meant to intimidate or to suggest that the great majority of Muslims support it. Probably 80% of them don't, to throw out a number. We're not sure of the right number. But it's more than enough to understand something very powerful about the Middle East, that it is religious extremism which is really motivating not just ISIS, but whether we're talking about Al-Qaeda, we're talking about Al-Shabaab, we're talking about the Houthis, who are variants of this down in Yemen, that religious radicalism is on the rise in the Middle East today in a way that causes us a lot of alarm.
And let's connect the dots just real quick before we talk more about ISIS, because you're talking about the Houthis down in Yemen and what's happening, and Boko Haram just
signed on,
whatever, yeah, pledged allegiance, rebranded themselves as what, you know, the term that people have been using, which it sounds funny when people use those terms with regard to terrorist groups, but they've they franchise themselves, and so they're allowed to use the name, and they get money and all sorts of things. Do you see the Hutus in Yemen doing the same thing? Is that connection? Well, I guess it wouldn't be, because Iran is supporting. Yeah,
right.
I misspoke on that. Iran is supporting the Hutus. So Why don't you go ahead and explain
that's why
that?
I didn't say Sunni. I said very carefully religious extremism. It can come in a Sunni form. It can come in a Shiite form. But in either form, it poses a significant danger, not just to the peoples that live in those particular countries in the Middle East, but to the United States and the Europeans and others, you know, who value everything that we've stood for the last several hundred years.
Right. And, you know, I know that, for example, in Iran, which is Shia and mm-hmm. ISIS is Sunni, there are some that, you know, believe in this, I guess it's the 12th Imam. Is that right?
Right. He was suspended in animation, I think it was in the 9th century, and is going to come back. And his return will be preceded by cataclysm and catastrophe and then the ultimate triumph of Shiite Islam.
And I assume that that clashes with this idea of ISIS's caliphate.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the irony is not just among religious groups. If you go back, I study Soviet Union and Russia today and China. If you go back, the people that hate each other are not the people who are far apart. You know, they're not the conservative Republicans and the communists, for example. They just don't have anything to argue about. They just disagree on everything. But the people that hated each other were the socialist and the communist. Or in the Republican Party, it's often the Tea Party and the moderates in the Tea Party, because they're the ones who are close enough that they think the other side should believe in them. And that's what we've got here that's similar, that different variants exist, but the ones who often have the greatest enmity are those who actually, from our external point of view, are really not all that different. But that clash is also a critical one in what's going on today. And you see it with the Saudis now, and supported by the UAE, supported by the Egyptians. The Sunnis are intervening to try to defeat the Houthis, who are about a third of the population in Yemen, and, you know, are backed up by the Iranians and the Revolutionary Guard.
And that's just something that just happened, and I think it was yesterday mm-hmm. that Saudi Arabia led a fairly large scale bombing into Yemen.
Right, and that's because of the very lengthy border that they have between Yemen and Saudi Arabia, and they also have their own concern. Because Saudi Arabia does have Shiites. Now, they're only 10 to 15% of population, but they happen by accident or whatever to be situated around the oil fields. And therefore, you know, the Saudis are deeply worried about what the United States is doing in Lausanne with the Iranians. They're deeply worried about what's going on in Egypt in terms of the radicals, Al-Ansar, which in Sinai has also pledged allegiance to ISIS. And all of this for a country that, you know, what they're doing now is building a 1,000-mile border fence with Yemen to seal it off. But they know that's not enough. They're building up their military power at the same time.
And
they are the ultimate Sunni force.
Right, right. And ironically, after Saudi Arabia did the bombing, the calls against Saudi Arabia, they were the, make sure I get this right, the Zionist Saudis is what they were shouting?
Yes. It's totally ironic, but the irony is, among many, many ironies here, is that the Israelis, having to choose sides here, don't have any problem. They're in deep fear of Iran having nuclear weapons, and they have fought, of course, with Hezbollah, and preparing to fight, if necessary, against the Iranian Revolutionary Guard in Lebanon, and so forth, and they're advanced to the Golan Heights even. But the reality is that the radicals have done something that no one thought was possible. A substantial part of the Arab world, whether they're talking Egypt or Jordan, which already have peace treaties with Israel, or Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, are much more terrified about Iran with nuclear weapons than Israel, which is a stable democratic state. So it's not Zionist at all. In fact, the Israelis technically can't even visit Saudi Arabia. But it illustrates the radical changes that are happening right now in the Middle East.
All right. We got to take a break. When we get back, I want to get back to where we started, which is why trying to de-Islamify ISIS is really a bad idea. But we'll do that when we get back, so stick around on Between the Synapses.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
There are over 140 million products manufactured worldwide. It is impossible to know the ingredients in these products, especially those made overseas. Stan Salat, creator of the HSF Mark and the Counterfeit Mark Alliance, is the host of People to People, working together for your safety. Stan believes in our right to know the type and amount of hazardous materials in consumer products and whether they are counterfeit. Find out how you can protect yourself every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Variety.
What can you find on Get Real Radio? Well, quite honestly, who you really are. Join host James Robinson each week for a program designed to reveal more about yourself and your world through words of wisdom and profound guests. You'll discover more about the spiritual movement and how it can work with you and alert you to problems you may not be aware of. It will educate, titillate, and enlighten your mind. Get Real Radio is broadcast live every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. This could end up being the best time of your week.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one Internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are listening to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. If you want in on this week's discussion, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to mbt@betweenthesynapse.com or on Twitter at @BetweenTSynapse. Now, back to the show.
All right, welcome back to Between the Synapse. We are talking to Denver University Professor of International Studies, Jonathan Adelman, who is back for his second round on Between the Synapse, the first to do so. So we'll put him on Between the Synapse's Board of History for that as the first person to make a return appearance. We're talking about... yes, it is a huge distinction. Please put that on your CV.
First page.
That's right. Exactly. We're talking about ISIS, and we started talking about the effort in terms of in order to kind of stop their effort at international recruitment to de-Islamify ISIS, and then. We kind of started talking about the whole region, which is such a cluster now. We're no longer talking about countries in the Middle East. We're talking about groups and subgroups within these countries, and it's far more complicated than it ever was. And I do want to ask you about that, but before I want to ask you the question that I did before we broke. Which is this effort to de-Islamify ISIS, is it, in light of what we were just talking about, are there negative consequences to that?
Absolutely. It's very important to be able to know the essence of who the enemy is. And the failure to understand that can lead to gross misjudgment. We can think of Neville Chamberlain going to the Munich conference in the fall of 1938 and misunderstanding the entire nature of Nazi Germany and Adolf Hitler, even though the Nazis had made it fairly clear, but basically seeing them as a status quo power, part of the League of, what had been the League of Nations that they now were no longer in. And basically that all they wanted at that time, as Hitler convincingly said, was to reunify, to bring back the Germans, in this case the 3.5 million Sudeten Germans, back into Germany, just as he had done with Austria in the Anschluss earlier that year. So failure to understand the enemy, and in that case it cost almost 60 million lives before that was recognized, and the failure of, say, Britain and France to understand who they were facing and to make the deal. We now know that Joseph Stalin, for example, for all the evil that he represented, but we've been in the archives, actually wanted to make that deal. And if we made that deal, the British, the French, and the Russians, Hitler very likely wouldn't have even started World War II, according to what he had to say himself. So if we don't understand who the enemy is, we are going to make very serious mistakes. And in this case, to understand that, we're not talking fascism or communism here, we're talking, you know, Islamic radicalism. And understanding that also gets us into a lot of other important subjects. Once we understand that, then we have to say, kind of, quo bono, who's benefiting from all of this? And the biggest benefactor, the biggest beneficiary of everything going on in the Middle East today has been the Iranians. We just saw an advisor to the Grand Ayatollah Khamenei say this week in print that we Iranians are building the Persian Empire and our capital will be Baghdad. Now, normally, that's a big wake-up call right there. Then we have the Grand Ayatollah Khamenei at his Friday's prayer service saying, death to the United States, and it deserves it. Now, you've got to understand, the problem is that our mind revolts at this, just like it was revolted by fascism and often by communism. Now, who could believe this? But millions and tens and even hundreds of millions of people can believe this. So if we don't understand the nature of who is the enemy and what do they want to accomplish, and that's why you mentioned very aptly the whole notion of the return of, you know, from being suspended in animation and that being followed by catastrophe, global fighting, and the triumph of radical Islam. If we don't understand that, then we're going to make the mistake that I'm afraid is being made by many in the United States today who don't pay attention to who the enemy is, what they've done before, and what they're trying to do, and think that Iran, for example, is a status quo power. They've made it abundantly clear, and by their movement into Iraq, their movement with Hezbollah into Lebanon, their movement into Yemen, they have made it abundantly clear what their goals are.
And so what you're saying, and there's... But I guess there would be some who would say, all right, Iran is Iran, but it's not ISIS. ISIS, as bad as Iran is, ISIS is still an extreme outlier. What they're doing is so far off that it makes Iran look moderate, and my guess is there's some policymakers in this country who are making a choice. They're saying, look, somebody here is going to win, and if we got to choose between ISIS and Iran, we'd rather have Iran, because at least Iran is a country made up of people of varying kinds of thought, and, you know, sometimes there are people more extreme, less extreme, not, you know, and there's only a certain level of people that reach that extreme, whereas ISIS is only the extreme. And then you see the videos of the beheadings, and yes, you see some hangings in Iran, but you don't see the kinds of just, you know, Hollywood gruesomeness, which is real, coming out of ISIS. So then that's what I think people are talking about ISIS differently than they would Iran.
You're absolutely right that they are, but they're making a very serious mistake. Tony Zinni, who was the CENTCOM commander for the United States military only a couple of years ago, was interviewed recently. and the central command was the Middle East for the United States. And Tony Zinni said something very wise. He said, somebody asked him, if we were to deploy military force, not overpowered, not huge numbers, maybe 10 or 20,000 men, how long do you think, he was asked, it would take the United States military to wipe ISIS off the face of the earth? And you know what he said? He said, 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, they'll be gone. Because they're a bunch of amateurs. They don't have sophisticated weaponry. They are, you know, extremely vulnerable where they are. They don't have any serious airplanes. They don't have tanks. They are not serious. Iran is serious. First of all, most important, Iran is on the verge of having nuclear weapons. That's extraordinarily important. Secondly, Iran has now developed this notion of Persian Empire. ISIS is going to be gone in a few years, just like we rarely hear about some of the other radicals that Al-Qaeda has kind of gone underground and so forth. It's going to be defeated because it's not militarily significant. But Iran is significant with regards not only to its nuclear weapons, but its allies. As the leader of the Shiite movement, whether it's the Alawites in Syria, whether it's the Shiites who are in Iraq, whether it's the Houthi who are in Yemen, they are, and in Syria, and so in that region, they are building power, and they've made it extremely clear. So yes, it is disgusting what ISIS does. It's horrifying. But the reality is that compared to a state that has been around now for 40 years, that has built an extraordinary complex, which will give them, by one study, within 10 years, 100 nuclear bombs, and the fiery desire to use them to bring back the rightful dominance of the Persians in the Middle East, that's extraordinarily scary. And that's something that we need to confront. So I understand when people look just at what the two sides say. But the other point, I'll make it very quick, the other point is nobody looks at what the Iranians are saying. If you want to know what the Iranians are saying, all you got to do is look at MEMRI, the Middle East Media Research Institute, that every single day translates into English not only what the Iranians are saying, but all the major forces in the Middle East, and you can actually see the people say that. And when you do that, then you get a very different view here, because this is the same group that smashed the Green Movement in 2009, that executed 750 people last year, and that is saying that it wants to exterminate the state of Israel, and wants death to America is their first chant last Friday, and then death to Israel. That's right. Very scary when it's backed up by real military force and economic capability, which ISIS doesn't have.
And I agree with you. But I guess what I was trying to understand is the point of the Islamification argument. When it came to both, meaning how can you make it with regard to ISIS, but not to these other groups? And we got to take a break. If you could just ponder that for a second, then we'll touch on that when we get back. So we'll be right back, and hope you will as well on Between the Centers.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
How do you achieve the utmost success in your life, career, faith, relationships, and more? It's all here in The Business of Living with host Scott Ventrella. Scott has experience as an executive coach, sought-after speaker, and lecturer. He and his guests will offer practical solutions and strategies to help you move to the next level of success, no matter where you are in your life and career. The Business of Living airs live every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
American Heroes Network is a program for and about our American veteran heroes and their families. Join host Gary Ray as he shows what is being done to help our veterans and showcase the companies and organizations that are helping our veterans and their families rebuild their lives. Listen for American Heroes Network, live and powered by the Voice America Variety Channel, every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time.
Women can live their lives to the fullest and realize their dreams for growth and greatness. Georgine Summers knows. As host of On the Edge, Georgine will give you powerful tools and rules to help you change direction in your life and get rid of the fears that stop you from living your dreams. Stretch your boundaries and become the amazing person you've always wanted to be. On the Edge with Georgine Summers airs live every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Streaming live. The leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
You are listening to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. If you want in on this week's discussion, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to MVT at BetweenTheSynapse.com or on Twitter at BetweenTSynapse. Now, back to the show.
All right, all right, all right. Welcome back. I am here. I am your host, Mark Tobin, and this is Between the Synapse. You are our listeners, hopefully, live or sometime in the future. That is my prediction. I am talking to Jonathan Adelman, who is professor of international studies at the University of Denver, former dissertation advisor to Condoleezza Rice, and someone who has written extensively on not only his areas of expertise, which are Russia and China, which I hope to ask him a couple questions at least about Russia towards the end of the show, but also about the issues facing the Middle East. And we're talking about ISIS and Iran, and maybe some other countries that start with an I. Let me clarify a question that I asked you before the break, which is why – look, Islamic radical-based terror groups have been troubling us for quite some time. And while, you know, while there are certain people who fail to discriminate the theologies behind these groups with, you know, the vast majority of Muslims around the world, I think certainly most people understand that most Muslims don't practice the kind of religious or have the same kind of religious views that these people who follow these groups do. Yet, I've never heard arguments, both academic as well as coming from, leadership, that it is a group that has absolutely nothing to do with Islam. I've heard
and
that
the president
is,
said that. The president said that.
Right, right. I understand the argument that it is an outlier. I understand that it is a perversion. I understand that these are groups that take viewpoints from centuries ago and try to revert back to them. All these kinds of arguments. But to say that it is essentially made up out of, from scratch is something new to me. And I don't understand, why it's only being made to ISIS and not to Iran or to Hezbollah or to Al-Qaeda. And I wanted to maybe get your thoughts as to why you think that is.
Well, I think as you're talking, there are really several reasons. One is that the average American, and even most of the political leadership in this country, has never taken courses in the Middle East. They have never been there. They have never studied it. It's been remote. Even today, if you look at college students, where they go to travel, China's a rising power. You don't need 11,000 students from America out of 14 million go to China to study. They go to the usual places. And I can't deny it. I love them, too. They go to England. They go to France. They go to Italy. And they're all very lovable. But the bottom line is that those are countries which we've resolved all of our issues with. So I think first we should realize that if you took a test and administered it to the average, even college-educated American, you would be shocked at what the results are. People would know extremely little about any of these countries. And I myself have to admit that I didn't know almost anything about Yemen, for example, until this happened, because it wasn't a major player. So I think that's number one. There is a lack of knowledge that extends all the way up into the elite. I can tell in a previous administration, when I had a chance to meet a number of the people there in Washington who were running the show, that they made some comments which I can't even repeat, but about another part of the world, which showed complete lack of knowledge of what they were doing. So I think we got to realize that America is geographically isolated, that Americans have a happy history on the whole, with exceptions like Vietnam and so forth, but on the whole. And they don't pay much attention to this, except for the specialist. I think, secondly, the whole issue about religion has become something that's treated very differently now than it used to be, and there's a great deal of argument over, and I think a lot of politicians, even those who may understand the issue somewhat, would prefer to simply evade the issue by not talking about this. I think, thirdly, there is the rise in the United States of a significantly larger Muslim group, and in France, 5 to 6 million, and so forth. And I think there is the due interest in sensitivity, since most of them don't have anything to do with this, and most of them would probably condemn it. Why stir this up? But the bottom line is that, as I pointed out before, it's dangerous. It was dangerous with fascism. It was dangerous with communism. It was dangerous with monarchical authoritarian regimes. We don't understand what's driving them, where they want to go. And it's even more important, I would argue, to understand that with Iran, to understand this whole notion of this kind of apocalyptic conclusion to the world and the ultimate triumph of Shiite Islam. When you start to think about those issues, that helps focus your mind rather wonderfully, but in a terrifying way, on what's going on in the Middle East today and why we have serious problems there. And postmodernism, which is very common on university campuses and in certain circles, would say we shouldn't say anything negative about other countries, as if Vladimir Putin's is something we shouldn't do. We shouldn't be using military force. And that's the other side of this. If we're not labeling the other side correctly and understanding them, which isn't easy, and then we're not willing to use military force that we do have and to organize other countries together, then we become, in international affairs, at the mercy of revisionist rising powers, whether they're Russia in Europe, whether they're Iran in the Middle East, or they're China in Asia. And that's a serious problem overall for policymaking. Henry Kissinger made this roughly similar point very recently.
Okay, so explain that thought and the rise of that within academia. Is that because of, I guess, the term that first came to me is guilt of American action and unease with use of American force, or is it something different?
Well, I think that's a good start. There's no question that significant elements, especially in academia and in certain other circles, do think that on the whole the United States has not been a force for good and the international scene. I would beg to disagree, although there are obviously some cases where it wasn't, but overwhelmingly I would say it has been, and Europe is an outstanding example of that. But they feel that America has not quite the evil empire, but something close to that. It's the same thing when they look at the Middle East and they decide, as a recent UN report did, that Israel is, you know, the greatest, you know, terror threat in the Middle East. And you're like, but it's the only democratic regime there. In other words, they miss a whole lot of it because they have a certain bias in how they're looking at it. So that if America has been responsible for a lot of the bad things that are going on in the world. And these people are just reacting to the bad things the United States did. And we did support military dictators, there's no question about it, in fair part of the world, and so forth. Then we need to withdraw. We need to let them settle it. But these people are ahistorical. They don't understand that the rise of Germany led to, you know, Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany in World War I killed 10 million people, 56 million people in World War II, that the rise of Japan led to Japanese imperialism and Pearl Harbor and millions of more people being killed and 20 million being killed in China, and that that if we don't deal with this, that the world isn't any different. If you look at the leading future powers in the world today, they're China, they're Russia, they're Iran, and possibly India. The only one of them that's actually a democracy is India. Iran, you know, doesn't allow people, anyone the right to vote except to run for election, unless the Grand Ayatollah agrees. Vladimir Putin sees himself as basically a very authoritarian figure, and China is a communist regime. I think people, if I were to put it simply, are simply ignoring, maybe because they haven't gotten out there. I've been to Russia and China 24 times. I've been to the Middle East almost 10 times. You get a different feel if you go there. It's a shock to Americans to find out that they're not like us. They are very different. Sometimes it's okay, but sometimes it's a potential serious threat to the United States and to our allies even more, who are much closer, because we're 6,000 miles away from the Middle East on the East Coast, and they're much closer to it.
You know, this is a vast simplification, and I think that the idea of speaking softly, you know, the idea of being involved in negotiations, of using words that are helpful, not hurtful, is a good thing. But in some ways, you know, Teddy Roosevelt said it the best, which right. is, you know, speak softly but carry a big stick. Because if you don't have that big stick, whatever you say, whether you say it softly, whether you say it loudly, it's not going to matter.
Mark, I think you said something that's really good, which is, I was trying to summarize these people, and I think that's exactly it. Whether it's in this administration or is on college campuses or it's in other places, there are large groups of people who think it's America's fault. America has been responsible for much of this, and we should not be speaking loudly. We should be softly. And when I heard that the outgoing defense secretary was going to recommend that we go back to a budget as we had in 1941. And you think how unprepared the United States was for war. It took the United States until the middle of 1943 before we even could get into the war. And meanwhile, millions and millions of people had died in Asia and in Europe. So I think that's the other side that people ignore, which is that even at $600 billion, which sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money, we are not even spending 4% of our GNP, which is now over $16 trillion. So if we don't do it, when you look at the Europeans as they are confronting Russia, or looking in the Middle East, you notice they're not intervening virtually at all or in a very small way. It's because they've slashed their defense budget. They've been essentially free riders that the Americans will take care of it so that they don't need to be taken care of. They're all at under 2% GNP per cap, GNP being spent on defense. So there's big consequences to soft words and not a big stick. Then what happens? And second, the other thing we have to mention very briefly is, in America is not as powerful economically as it used to be. China is certainly rising in the world. Some of the other BRIC countries are doing well. And so in another 20 years, we also will face, for example, the Chinese just have their new investment bank that the Brits are going into, and the French and the Germans, to counteract the IMF and the World Bank. So we're going to have to figure out what our role in the world is. And I think that's maybe partly what's going on now, is that we're kind of going from what some people would argue is one extreme all the way to the other.
Yeah, no, I would definitely agree. And I want to touch on Russia and the Ukraine, because I know that's an area of your expertise. We got to take a quick break, and then we have a couple minutes to do that. So if you wouldn't mind sticking around for just a little while longer, we will do that after this break.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
Museums are great places to work and wonderful places to visit. But are they essential? How can we improve our museum practice so that museums remain vital and essential players in society? Listen for Museum Life with host Carol Bossert, where each week we'll discuss timely and topical issues of concern to the museum community. Museum Life can be heard live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Think of the world 50 years ago. Now think of this same world and how it'll be 50 years from now. Did you know that if the world's population continues to grow at its current rate, our children and grandchildren will only have 25% of the resources per capita that our parents and grandparents had? We must preserve the foundation of a quality standard of living. That foundation starts with Go Green Radio. Join your host, Jill Buck, for Go Green Radio every Friday at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Voice America.
In the spirit of Have Couch, We'll Travel, Dr. Carol Lieberman creates a haven of sanity in an increasingly insane world. Each day we are bombarded with news of events that have never crossed our wildest nightmares. Society is spiraling out of control and everyone is reeling from it. But now there's an answer. The best way to keep sane in this insane world is to tune in to Dr. Carol's Couch on Voice America. Dr. Carol, a certified media psychiatrist, will broadcast live from her Beverly Hills office every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Call or log in and get help with whatever is sending you reeling whenever you need a soothing voice to calm and advise you. That's Dr. Carol's Couch every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time here on America's Voice, voiceamerica.com.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time.
The number one Internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You are listening to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. If you want in on this week's discussion, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to mbt@betweenthesynapse.com or on Twitter at BetweenTSynapse. Now, back to the show.
Hey, I am Mark Tobin. I am your host on Between the Synapse. With me is Jonathan Adelman, a professor. A professor of international affairs at Denver University, talking about ISIS and the region of the Middle East. As I mentioned before, your original expertise is Russia and China. Just one more question before I ask you about Russia and the Ukraine. You know, most of these groups, you know, in Yemen, the Hutus and these other subgroups, names just, you know, not even coming to mind at the moment. You know, nobody ever. Not that they weren't there, but even somebody like me, who was fairly proficient at understanding the map of the Middle East, was not familiar with all these various groups, and all of a sudden, you know, they're on the front page. What? I mean, I think I know the answer, but I'd like to hear your take on it. You know, why now?
Right. Well, I think the why now goes back to a couple of things. First of all, it goes back to a series of failed attempts to transform the Middle East. And those attempts didn't take into account the nature of the Middle East, because you go back to the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which is this year 100 years old, and you're looking at what the British and French colonialist powers wanted to do there. And so you get countries Repeatedly, actually, whether you're talking about Iraq, which is 60% Shiite and 20 or 30% Sunni, and then the rest mostly Kurds, or you're talking about Syria, which is 60% Sunni, and then the minority, the Alawites, are in power, and they're Shiites and so forth. So that's the first thing. That's always been there. And usually one or the other has been dominant. Secondly, is a deeper failure. And that without which we wouldn't be seeing this kind of radicalism, which is the failure to create democratic regimes. To us in the West, with a country that started out as a democracy, however limited, without voting rights for women or, you know, African Americans or so forth, but still a semi-democratic regime that morphed into a very democratic regime, it's hard for Americans to understand why the Arab Spring failed in the last 4 years. But what they're ignoring is, what do you need to make the kind of viable democratic regime with which we are so fortunately associated in the United States or in Europe? And what you need is a multiple of things, all of which are lacking in the Middle East. Most importantly, you need a solid economy. You need a modern economy with a strong middle class that is capitalist, that is entrepreneurial, that is export-oriented. You need education. And the bottom line is that whereas education levels are very strong in the United States, where the average person did go to college or didn't graduate, in these parts of the world, you have huge numbers of people, sometimes in 10 of the 23 Arab states, the majority or near majority of women who are illiterate. Or in Egypt, where you get 42% of the women are illiterate and 20% of the men, and then another part are semi-literate, so they're illiterate. You need a tradition of tolerance. Now, that was hard even in the United States to get, but in these parts of the world, the minorities, like the Jews and the Christians and others, Christians were 20% of the Middle East in 1900, now they're 5%. In another century, they're probably going to be pretty much gone, except maybe in Israel and nearby. So you don't have the tolerance. You need to be in a good part of the world. It makes a big difference. If you're near the United States and you're Mexico, despite all the complaints you can rightfully have about the United States, you get NAFTA, and you get them now at $10,000 GNP per capita. So in a good region, that can really make a difference. But what's their region? If you're talking about Yemen, it's right next to Saudi Arabia, which is just oil rich. You've got Syria, you've got Iraq, you have Iran, and so forth. And we could go on, but we don't want to waste time and take too much time. The bottom line is that the basis for a modern democratic regime literally doesn't exist, and the fundamental core issues that have been resolved, often bloodily, in other countries, which has to do with who rules. Is it Sunnis? Is it Shiites? Is it Kurds? What about women? What about religion? Without Reformation, as we got with Christianity and the Protestant Reformation in 1517, or in Jewish Reformation, which basically was reform and conservative Judaism in 1840s and 1890s and so forth. Without that, then religion often becomes the one place where the hostility towards repressive authoritarian regimes can be expressed in the mosque and with legitimacy. And so when you think about all of that together, it's actually not what's surprising is that the authoritarian regimes lasted as long as they did. Not that they were a good thing. Saddam Hussein killed 300,000 people. But now that they've broken down, this part of the world is going into its constituent parts. And the kinds of people we like, the democratic secularists, as we see in Syria and elsewhere, are a small group, very sadly.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, you're right on. And my only add-on, and I don't know if you agree at what level of this is that our current and our most recent administration, their actions both were essentially are and were the exact wrong actions, meaning going into, you know, Iraq with this idea, you know, and even Afghanistan, of establishing democracy right away, which, because of what you just said, the conditions weren't ripe, and expecting democracy, and setting expectations throughout the region, which then led to the, which I think we can now say is a failed Arab Spring,
Right.
And now creating these conditions was set by the Bush administration by what they thought was going to be an overnight setup of democracy. Obama comes in, and he is, wants to take a 180-degree turn instead of a 90-degree turn. And that makes things even worse. So, you know, I blame both. One for kind of opening the box and one for taking the box and essentially ripping it open. I mean, just, you know, destroying the box. And both of them, I think, are based on what you said earlier, which is lack of understanding of the
right.
Region.
And I agree with
and
you.
And unfortunately, we're going to have
about both administrations.
Yeah, we're going to have to stop right here. I know we could go on for a very long time. We may have to do that offline, but that's all the time we have right now. So, Jonathan, thank you so much for coming back. I'm sure
you'll join
us again and be our first triple guest here on Between the Synapse. But anyway, thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. I hope you join us next week on Between the Synapse. Take care.
Thanks again for joining us this week. Mark Tobin and Between the Synapse will transmit once again next Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. And remember, you never know what lies between the synapse.